I'm Christopher Lydon with the philosopher and storyteller Kwame Anthony Appiah. He is on the trail of moral revolutions, how it is that esteemed practices like English dueling on points of honor, or the binding of Chinese women's feet, or the slave trade for that matter, suddenly collapse under ridicule and an alternative definition of what is really honorable. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude. We call it. In your book, The Honor Code, how close do you think you've come to finding a key to this fluctuating market of morality?
In the course of doing the work for the book, I did feel that I'd noticed something that didn't seem to have been noticed before. And I do think it's something important, which is, as we'll talk about, the way in which honor figures in getting people who already can see that something is wrong then to do something about the fact that it's wrong. I do think that's the big question. So the first question is, how do you get people to, which a lot of people have thought about and written about, which is, how do you get people to see that something's wrong? But the next phase is, okay, they see that it's wrong, but they're still doing it, right? So what takes them from that stage to the next? Now, I think these questions of honor are helpful in understanding that process. There are obviously other things that matter. One obvious thing that matters beyond honor is you've got to get people organized. The difference between a lot of individual people thinking something is wrong and changing things is very often getting people to get into groups. And in all the stories that we're going to talk about, there are associations. There's an anti-dueling association. There's our anti-foot-banding associations. There are abolitionist societies. There are people who get together and confirm their sense that something is not just wrong but dishonorable. But still, to get from recognizing that it's wrong to organizing to do something about it, I think honor is a crucial intermediating step.
I want to ask you to imagine how you'd apply it to those immoral things that we take for granted now, maybe even eternal warfare or more and more inequality in a society that at least nominally prizes equality. But explain how it worked in some of the cases you write about. So entertainingly, dueling, honor killing, even today in Pakistan, for example, of women who have broken some or have been forced to break some rule of sexual behavior. How did those work?
Well, the book starts with the dueling case, and part of the reason for that is that that's how I got into it, because it seemed to me I should try and understand a relatively straightforward case before going into the more complicated ones. I'm so glad that I did start with dueling, because here's the big surprise, I think, about dueling, and it teaches you something deep about honor. I hadn't realized when I started looking at how dueling came to an end in England, I hadn't realized that throughout the sort of 300 years in which it was a standard elite practice to duel, it was illegal, condemned by the church, and widely understood to be immoral. So there were all these reasons against it, and yet for several hundred years it went on anyway. And that just shows you, I think, something about the power of honor. Honor gave people a reason to do something that the church condemned, that was illegal, and that they understood to be morally problematic. And also, by the way, they understood that it was crazy, because a duel is crazy because it's a dispute between two people which is settled by a mechanism whose answer doesn't depend on who's right. Hamilton, Burr, who was right? I don't know who was right, but we know who died. And the fact that someone dies in a duel doesn't actually mean that they were wrong. And nobody had any difficulty understanding this. It wasn't that they said, oh, no, it is a good way of settling these questions, or, oh, no, it's perfectly moral, or, oh, no, the church is wrong. It's just that they said, honor pulls us to do this thing. We understand that there are all these reasons against it. So that's the first thing that I think it's important to learn about honor is that it can work very powerfully against morality and religion and reason and so on. So you have to be very careful of it. And if I'm defending it, I want to begin by acknowledging that it has all these difficulties. But the second thing you learn from the dueling case is that if you shift the code, you can turn honor in the right direction. You can turn honor away from this crazy thing towards making people do the right thing. Because within a 20, 30-year period between the Duke of Wellington's duel in 1829 or whenever it was and 1850, it goes from being a way to maintain your honor to being ridiculous. People laugh at you if you if you actually duel, and they laugh at you if you challenge them to duels. They just think you're ridiculous. And that means that it stops. It can't work anymore. It can't do its job. And it just does sort of, as it were, screech to a halt.
Hmm.
So I think reform of honor can turn it from pushing people in a bad direction to pushing them in a good direction. That's what I, the conclusion I drew from thinking about the dueling case.
It sounds like an extension of William James's moral equivalent of war, in the sense that he was trying to turn a vaguely patrician, vaguely honor-bound, vaguely violent, bad old habit into something much better, to keep the trappings but get rid of the sin somehow.
Yeah, I hadn't actually, until you said that to me, I hadn't thought about that connection, but I think it's right that I would only say that because of what I just said, I'm resistant to the old idea, which goes back to Aristotle, of thinking of honor as part of morality. I think of honor as this separate system which you can turn to the ends of morality, but which is going to be there doing its work, if whether or not it's going to do the moral thing. But the idea of mobilizing this very powerful sentiment, which has been used indeed largely and significantly to get men to do violent things, to get men to fight wars, to get, you know, Achilles riled up, to get the Duke of Wellington riled up, turn that set of energies towards doing good things. Remember, the Duke of Wellington, you know, he was the conqueror of Napoleon and all that, but the very same kind of psychological energies that sustain military honor and the honor of a feudal nobility, the honor of Achilles, turn out to be usable and by men, but also by women, to push them to do other things. And it's that mechanism, that connection, right, between thinking that... So if I could, I mean, maybe this is the point to say that I think the heart of honor is not very complicated. The heart of honor is that you have a system, a socially sustained system, which says what you have to do and avoid doing in order to be entitled to be respected. That's the heart of honor. It's a system for allocating entitlement to respect. And an honorable person is someone who cares not just about respect, which we all care about, everybody cares about being respected, but about being entitled to respect, about deserving respect. That concern to be respected and entitled to respect can turn people in the direction of morality. Unfortunately, as we see in gang warfare in the streets, it can turn people against morality too, because that's all about respect and not being dissed as well. So, you know, many people's natural instinct faced with the violent testosterone-driven side of honor is to say, this is crazy, we should give it up. And about that, I only want to say, just try. I mean, I don't think it's possible. We can manage it, we can direct it, but I am skeptical of the thought that we can get rid of it.
Can I go back to William James just one second?
Sure, yes,
seems
absolutely.
To me he was wrestling with exactly the same puzzle. We're the creatures of a merciless Darwinian sort of tooth and claw evolution, and yet it's come now, he was writing 100 years ago, come now to horrific destructive power. So how do we displace it into Boy Scouts, into athletics, into other manly ranked effort that somehow absorb all that,
yes,
all that brutal energy? How do you turn honor away from mass killings,
yeah,
or rape of women that are considered tainted into a productive, humane resolution?
Well, I think
that also has honor embedded in it.
Yes. So again, I mean, in Pakistan, you look at honor in Pakistan and you say, shouldn't we just try and stop this? Shouldn't we just try and stop them thinking about honor at all? First of all, if you're an outsider, they already think we don't understand honor. So coming in and telling them to give it up is just completely unlikely to have any impact at all. They already think we're without honor because we don't kill our women. So coming in and telling them that they should give it up is just not going to work. But here's some things that are actually going on in the work of anti-honor-killing organizations, often led by women, but not exclusively led by women in Pakistan. One thing they're pointing out is that, there, in effect, they don't put it this way, is that there's a tension within the existing honor system. Because part of what, of course, male honor consists in is defending and protecting your women, and also in picking on people your own size. So there are these two things about the existing honour system that are already against killing girls in your own family. One, it's killing women, which is too easy. And two, it's not protecting the very women that your honour is tied up with protecting. In other words, the women of your own family, your own mother, your own sister, your own daughter. So that's one powerful set of arguments which is going on. And just sort of repeating the point that there isn't any honour in that, I think, is working, and it should work. But the second thing, and this moves us from individual honour to collective honour, which I think is the really powerful force in political change, Pakistan was created for the Muslims of South Asia. It's constitutionally a Muslim state. Being a state, being the state in the world which has the highest number of honor killings, brings dishonor not just to Pakistan, but to Islam. And that's very important because honor killing is not an Islamic practice. There's no Muslim defense of honor killing, despite the fact that many of the people who do it are Muslims. Many of the people who do it in South Asia are not Muslims, they're Hindus, they're Sikhs. It used to be quite common in the Christian world, in the Balkans, and even in Italy. It's a very, very old Mediterranean practice, basically, and it's gone in some places, but it's not Islamic. It's un-Islamic. It, for various reasons, is inconsistent with Sharia traditions. So there's a Muslim reason not to do it, tied up with the thought that if you are a country created to be the home of Islam, to be a kind of beacon of what Muslim statehood would look like, you can't afford to do something that's un-Islamic and shameful in the eyes of the world.
The really good news, I suppose, in this book, The Honor Code, is that when these moral revolutions come, they come very, very fast. Dueling ended in the middle of the 19th century. Slavery had ended in the English slave trade had ended in the 1830s. Foot binding in China died a very sudden death in the early 20th century. So apply it. How would you address those lessons and that history to the moral lapses that we're all struggling with in this 21st century? I want to get to war, but I think of other things, especially inequality, which is, by every account, a kind of moral and economic albatross around the United States and the world.
Yes.
What's to do?
Well, so let's take the question of quality in the United States. Let's be totally local about this. As I said, I think that you've got to go through three steps. First of all, you've got to get people to grasp what the moral problem is, and that there is a moral problem. And I'm going to say in a moment, I think that's sort of not, that's over. We know there's a problem. The second thing is you've got to get honor mobilized to get us to see that it's shameful that there's a problem. And then we need to organize to do something about it. That's the kind of the three phases. And then, as you said, the historical evidence is that once you get to that point, there's a kind of build up and then there's a flip. And then there's what my friend Malcolm Gladwell likes to call a tipping point, and then suddenly it's done. I mean, it may take 20 years, which is a short time in the history of the world and a short time in the history even of the United States. I think we have to be clear about what the problem is in the United States, though, because I think there isn't a consensus about exactly what the source of the difficulty about inequality is. My own view is this. The main problem of inequality, both within the United States and in the world, is that there are lots of people who aren't getting what they're entitled to, who aren't getting the basic means for living a decent human life, a life of human dignity in this very rich society.
Right. In Waiting for Superman, you know, it's up to a gamble in the end, whether a kid gets to a school that'll develop his capacity.
Yeah, and that shouldn't be. It's our society, it's our responsibility. It reflects badly on us, you and me as American citizens, and all the other American citizens who aren't doing anything about it. So I think that's the problem. I myself don't think there's something intrinsically bad about, you know, differences in wealth. I think there's something corrupting to a political system to have small numbers of people with so much wealth that they can have a hugely disproportionate impact. And again, I think that that's not terribly controversial. There may be a few there may be a few very rich people who don't agree, but by and large, Americans think that it ought not to be the case that a billionaire can put his thumb on the scales and shift our political system. Even if you agree with the billionaire, you don't really think that. So it's not that there's any difficulty about seeing the problem. What we don't, I think, have yet is a strong sense that it's, as it were, our problem, that is our collective problem, and that therefore it's we should be ashamed of ourselves.
So what's the trigger we're looking for? We know there's something wrong. We know it's costing us. We know it's an embarrassment, shame. Then what?
Well, part of the difficulty is that I'm not sure that everybody's really faced up to the facts here. One of the things that I talked about in the piece I read about this is there's a kind of moment of what I call strategic ignorance, where people deliberately turn their eyes away from the facts. That's why this recent documentary, Waiting for Superman, is important, because it's rubbing our noses in the facts. It's requiring, we can't turn our eyes away if it works, if a documentary like that works. So a lot of people sort of think, it's terrible, but, you know, I'm not going to think about it. So you've got to get people thinking about it. That's one thing. And this is the moment at which there's a kind of possibility of combining organization, both, I think, on the small, on issue by issue, that is, looking at education, looking at work, employment, and so on, separate as separate problems, but also a kind of general, somehow, we need to be organizing ourselves to think. We want to be a society that can say, honestly to itself, looking in the mirror in the morning, we are a society which takes seriously the idea that equality and opportunity matter, and that they're not just rhetoric, they're not just things we say in order to cheer ourselves up. If you can get that organized, if you can get people into societies where they say to each other, I am committed now to making our society live up to these standards, then the other things happen too. That is, it's harder and harder for people to engage in strategic ignorance, because you look dumb if you say, we have equality of opportunity in our society, because everybody knows we don't. It's embarrassing to be caught saying something pious but false about your own society, I think, provided there are people who are underlining the fact that it's false.
Anthony Appiah, speak to torture as a kind of instance of the same question. A lot of strategic ignorance about torture, yeah, too. But it was, we know it's wrong. It's a universal human taboo. And yet it was suspended in the Bush administration. And we're still getting over it. But where does that fit?
Well, it fits in the story, because I think it's one of the things, kind of officially, centrally sanctioned torture, and the things that it led to, like Abu Ghraib, where you can argue that it wasn't actually commanded by the top people. They didn't actually say do those things, but they created a context, having broken the taboo, they created a context in which people felt apparently free to do those things. And I think it's terrible that we focused so much on the people who were actually at the bottom of the heap here, who were doing it, who were at the sort of sharp end, as it were, and didn't focus enough on how we had created an atmosphere which made it possible for them to do it. But that's a separate question. But I think that when Americans know that these things have been done in their name, or face up to the fact, they can't feel any, unless they don't care about our country, they can't feel anything but shame. And that's because they understand that you're not entitled to respect if you do things like that. So I think that's an example of the mechanism in operation. I think that's why a government that wants to do these things has to do them in the dark. You said earlier that it's important to understand pragmatism, the values of pragmatism. I think one of the values of pragmatism, which we completely lose when we behave like this, is that we lose our sense of what we're actually doing. This is so counterproductive. Nothing that we're trying to do in the world is advanced by being seen as the country that does this thing. We used to be seen as a country that wouldn't do these things. It was understood that Syria would do these things, or that old Iraq would do these things. We understand that the Saudis, you know, stone people and beat people up. But we used to be able to claim that we were trying to not to do these things, that if we did them, if we found them done, we would punish them, that we would go to the UN and in the Human Rights Commission and complain when other countries do that. We can't do any of that anymore. We look ridiculous when we're doing those things, because we're doing it. So I think this is, as it were, an element of soft power is honor. An element of soft power is honor. And if you lose your honor, you don't lose all your honor, you lose it only in a certain dimension each time, then you have to regenerate it. You have to earn it back in order to be able to use that kind of soft power, which is the most powerful form of political resource we have in the world as Americans, I think. It's the respect that we have sometimes earned and sometimes not earned that makes all kinds of people who disagree with us about all kinds of things nevertheless have a kind of sneaking admiration for the United States.
I want to come back to that matter of the mix of moralism and pragmatism, but stick with the question of war. Your subtitle is How Moral Revolutions Happen. And it seems to me we're in a continual moral revolution on this matter of war, to the extent even that Barack Obama, running for president, in saying Iraq was a bad war, had to come up with a good war in Afghanistan, yeah, or the right war, or the inevitable war. We're approaching a kind of assumption of permanent war in this country. And I wonder, A, how that moral revolution arrived, and how it's to be undone.
Part of the difficulty with war here is that once you grant that you're going to have an army, the permanent army, professional permanent military system, and I do grant that. I think in the contemporary world, you just have to accept that for a large country, that's a necessity. I'm not sure that Ghana needs an army, but the United States does. Once you accept that, then you have to recognize that armies work on honor. Armies are the things, the very strange things that you can get, especially young men, to do, the extraordinary risks you can get them to take, depend upon mobilizing honor, and that's why the Marines teach honor, and that's why if you told them that they had to do without it, they'd tell you they couldn't. And they're right, they couldn't. They can't do the astonishing things they do. And there are various interesting things about the way in which honor actually is a good solution to the problem of getting people to do these things that we need people to do if we're going to have armies. For example, unlike money and unlike the criminal law, honor doesn't require you to have an apparatus for enforcement. It enforces itself. The mere fact that all of us will have contempt for people who do certain dishonorable things, it's just sitting there. So all that has to happen is for us to find out. And in fact, once you've trained young men and women now into honor, there doesn't even have to be an audience. They'll feel shame if they do a dishonorable thing if there's nobody there. So in the fog of war, when you can't have surveillance, when you can't use the normal mechanisms of social surveillance in order to reward people with money or to punish them with criminal sanctions, it's just sitting there waiting, doing its job. So honor is necessary, I think, in this context, powerful, and we can't do without it. So I think war is a terrible thing. It may be necessary sometimes, and that means that because it's morally terrible, because its costs are so high, never mind its economic costs, just its moral costs are so high, you shouldn't do it unless there's a really substantial moral benefit to come from it, something that you really think you have to do. Now, as I say, I'm not a pacifist. I think that condition can be met. But it wasn't met in Iraq when we went in the last time. And I think it's clear that that we're not getting morally worthwhile benefits from the continuation of the war in Afghanistan, which has everyday costs. It delays the development of a civilian society in Afghanistan. Every day, people in Afghanistan and Pakistan are killed by our bombs. The question isn't whether, given that we're there, those things are morally justified or not. The thing is, they will happen so long as we're there in a military capacity. And the question is whether the world, on balance, is getting anything for it, anything that we have an interest to make sure that the world gets. And I just don't know what that is. I mean, nobody has explained to me any time recently what the heck we're doing there. So I think war is not intrinsically impermissible, but in the contemporary world, it's very hard to see cases where these sorts of wars will get us something that's worth the compensating moral cost. Never mind economic cost. Let's just focus on the moral
cost. I think
that
feeling is latent everywhere. And my puzzle is what's the mechanism for activating it? In your histories, it's ridicule in a way that brings down what everybody knows is a kind of uneasy practice. And sometimes I think if Rip Van Winkle woke up and heard that we were triggering robot drones hitting wedding parties in Afghanistan, he would find that absurd,
yes,
and ridiculous.
It is absurd.
And it might stop.
Well, it's a bit of a mystery to me because my sense is that large numbers of people over quite a broad range of the American political spectrum have already got this about Afghanistan. We already can see that it's. I mean, the trouble with saying it's ridiculous is that that understates the problem, because from a moral point of view, because it's not just ridiculous, it's, as it were, scandalous that all these people lives are being disrupted and these people are being killed. I do not really, I'm not enough of a politician to understand what it is about where we are that means that that our current leadership, which was rightly skeptical about another recent war, can't see that we just need to move very swiftly to ending this one. I mean, part of the problem is, and this is a question of honor, is the Powell Doctrine, right? If you break it, it's yours. And to a certain extent, Afghanistan was sort of already broken long before the United States intervened most recently, by the British and then by the Russians and everybody in between. But now it's definitely our crockery that's broken there. And so there would be something dishonorable about going in like a bull in a china shop, making a terrific mess, and then just leaving and not being involved in the process of trying to clean it up. But I just think that the process of trying to clean it up is not going to be done by the Marines. It has to be done some other way. And until we face up to that, this argument of honor that says, well, you know, we have some responsibility for this mess because we helped create it, is going to tempt people to think, well, we just have to leave the soldiers there because, after all, they do something. And the thing is, the thing that the pragmatist ought to say is, yeah, they're doing something, but it isn't helping. So we should figure out something else to do that is useful, or at the very least, stop breaking things, stop making more trouble. And this, the thought that this is a defeatist response, the thought that this is, you know, Chamberlain and Munich or something, is one of the bad sides of honor. It's people thinking that they have to defend their honor even when it's crazy. That's what dueling is. Dueling is defending your honor even when it's crazy to do so. We're not getting anything out of this, right? We, the world, the United States, to pick your person. Nobody's getting, except the arms manufacturers, they're getting something.
I'd love to get a philosopher's take on the different standards of pragmatism and a kind of moralism. Pragmatism asking basically, does it work? Are we getting a result that we like? Mm. And moralism driving hard on the question of, is it right? Is it right ethically, religiously even, in the eyes of eternity or God, is it right? It came up interestingly with Noam Chomsky the other day talking about Iraq. He would not have signed an ad that colleagues of his wrote saying a war with Iraq is not in the American national interest. He says there's no morality in national interest. He would have preferred, and his own ad would have stressed, the illegality, the immorality of that kind of intervention. And I've been thinking ever since, which is the really useful test for a policy? Which sensibility would you want to be deeply embedded in the Congress, in the country, in the military? Is it going to work, or, you know, can you justify it on a moral plane?
I think part of the difficulty with what we call moralism is that kind of concern for your own moral purity over and above a concern for the real effects of what you're doing in the world, which include the moral effects, but not only the moral effects. You can't have, it's not plausible to have a kind of politics that simply asks the question, have we done the very best thing a person could do? Very best thing from the moral point of view. Because, first of all, a lot of politics has to be about things where morality isn't a very important component of the question. It has to be about, you know, what policies are going to work to keep the economy moving and that kind of thing. And what we need to think about, it seems to me, always is, what'll work? And I think often appeals to morality are, in politics, and this is moralism, tend to be attempts to distract us from the question whether something is actually working. So we're in a just cause. Okay, but are we advancing the just cause? That's the question. So I do think that, you know, moral considerations obviously matter in everything. They matter in everyday life, and they matter in politics. But they aren't the only thing that matters. And banging on about our moral purity, as opposed to worrying about whether we're advancing the things we ought to be advancing, which include moral concerns but don't exclusively consist of moral concerns, is not helpful. And so I think that the fact that a war is not in our interest, where our interest includes, I think, our moral interests. I mean, the United States has interests in advancing certain moral concerns as well, and that's always been part of the understanding in the great consensus in our politics about what American interest means. We always, within the framework of interest, talk about moral concerns, in fact. But so if you take interest in the way in which it's normally taken, advancing the fact that a war doesn't advance our interest is an incredibly good reason not to do it. I mean, what could be a better reason, it seems to me? The fact that it's immoral is a reason against it. But if it doesn't even advance our interests, you don't have to get to the question of whether it's moral. You don't have to argue about whether it's moral. And I think that it really was true. And I speak as a reformed person here, because I was not clear about the wrongness of this current Iraqi war when it started, because I hated Saddam Hussein enough that I, not for the same reasons as George Bush, but because I thought about all those gassed Kurds and so on, that I was distracted from thinking about the question that I believe I should have been thinking about, it, which is, what can happen that's good out of this, good morally, but also good in advancing the cause of the of democracy in the world, of Iraq, and so on. And by those standards, it was from the beginning clear that it wasn't going to be worth it. And in the meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of people have died, trillions of dollars have been spent, tens of thousands of American veterans are wounded in body and spirit. And it was clear, I think, from the beginning, to those who were moderately clear-sighted, more clear-sighted than I was, that we weren't going to get anything that would justify those costs. Of course, we didn't admit what the costs would be at the start. We never do. That's another problem with warfare. Nobody ever predicts correctly the cost. They always underestimate the costs.
I think of Edmund Burke a lot lately, 18th century English politician, announced that he would not be the tool of his constituency. He would draw in his own judgment. And he also had a great sense of the long moral arc of Britain and its behavior in India, of which he was enormously critical.
That's true.
Do we have an exemplar in modern America of the man who wants to be judged on his principles over the long term?
Yeah, so the American sort of honorable American that leaps to my mind is the guy that I talk about in my book, is Captain Ian Fishback, who was in both Afghanistan and Iraq, in fact, but in Iraq saw things that he thought were inconsistent with what he'd been taught about the laws of war at West Point, where he was a successful student, and he did heroic things. I mean, he first of all, he checked in with his laws of war professor at West Point. He said, "I've seen this. Is this right?" And then when he heard that the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Rumsfeld, had said that, of course, our troops were governed by the Geneva Conventions, he said, "I didn't know that. I've been in Afghanistan. I've been in Iraq. I got the impression that we weren't. I thought we'd been told we'd been liberated from those constraints, because this was not, you know, conventional warfare. We weren't dealing with a military opponent." And again, he went and consulted his chain of command. He consulted the Judge Advocate General's office, and basically everybody let him down. And so, after doing the proper thing, he said, "Look, I am one of the things I was taught as an officer is I behave honorably, and I don't allow or encourage or lead my men to do dishonorable things. That's one of my jobs. So I'm not going to do it." And in the end, he actually wrote to the Senate. He wrote to Senator McCain, and it was his letter really that led to Senator McCain's successful attempts to change the law so that it was clear that these things like torture were not going to be part of the practice of the American military because they were inconsistent with our legal obligations. So,
and Donald Rumsfeld is quoted saying about this Captain Ian Fishback, "Either break him or destroy him and do it quickly."
Yeah.
Shocker.
Now, yes, but I'm afraid that a lot of people would just assume that that is what a modern Secretary of Defense who was a politician would say. They would just assume that he would be out to destroy someone who was only doing what he had been told he was supposed to do as an American officer, which is observe the laws of war and defend the honor of his himself, his troops, and his country. And this is not just valor. This is not the kind of military honor that leads you to shoot people or kill people. This is the kind of honor that says we are honorable people in a difficult circumstance, and so we're going to hold to our own standards, whatever the other people around here are doing. And in this case, these were standards of respect for human dignity and life. These were, but they were connected in his mind, rightly, not only with his individual honor, but with the honor of his unit and with the honor of his country. And I'm a great admirer of his, and I think he's not the only one. He's just, I mean, there are, fortunately, it's not as if we don't have honorable people in our armed services. We do, who understand honor correctly, that it's not a matter of doing what the generals tell you to do. It's a matter of doing what your conscience and the laws of war tell you to do. And the laws of war are very explicit that many of these things that we have in fact done are illegal. And even if the laws of war weren't clear, anybody with a smidgen of moral ideas can see that we shouldn't have been doing some of the things we were doing.
Anthony Appiah, I want to hear your own wish list for applying the process that you discovered, the process of moral revolution, the honor code, which involves sort of surfacing the misgivings about bad things we do over and over, examining deeply the real claim of honor in private and public situations. I mean, where would you go with that insight?
I think for our own country, I would say there are lots of possibilities. I'm just going to mention some that I've been thinking about. One, I think, is to do with what one might call the great incarceration. The fact that this country, which is maybe the home of the brave, but it's also supposed to be the land of the free, has now a quarter of the world's prisoners. Right? We're 4% of the world population. We have nearly 25% of the world's prisoners. This is just a scandal. It should be shocking to us. It just can't be that the people of the United States are more criminal than the people of Jamaica or Rwanda or China. It just can't be. The explanation has to be something we are doing wrong, that we're locking all these people up. And clearly part of what we're doing wrong is locking up large numbers of people who pose no threat to anybody for involvement in the use of drugs. It's another question about whether a free country would criminalize the use of these drugs. But so I think there's one where and this is one of these cases where we've got this strategic ignorance. People are not focused on what's going on in our prisons, on the fact that we have so many prisoners, on the fact that you're more likely to have TB when you come out of an American prison than when you go in. You're more likely to have AIDS when you come out of an American prison than when you go in. You're more likely to be raped as a man in an American prison than anywhere else in the United States, and so on. These are just scandalous truths about our system. The federal system isn't quite as bad as some of the state systems, but even in the federal system, it's not terrific. So I think that's one where I really do think the people who are trying to draw our attention to these things are doing, you know, God's work, and I think they should be encouraged. And I do think that when people look back on this moment, that's one of the things they will just find as puzzling as you know, we find dueling or slavery or foot binding. There's another big revolution already underway, I think, in attitudes to animals. I think that, when I came to this country, it wasn't the case at Yale and Harvard and Princeton that, because I first taught in Yale in this country, that there was a vegetarian option in all the dining halls. Now, for lots of reasons, some of them health-related, but many of them moral, and as a result of a movement organized by animal rights people, many people feel that while we are treating animals in our food production system the way we are, you can't honorably be involved with eating them. My own view is there's nothing wrong with killing animals. What's wrong with the cruelty of the process by which we feed them up and also the fact that we kill them sometimes in a particularly distressing way, in a way distressing to them, shouldn't be distressing to us. But and I think that's another one where people are just going to look back and say, what on earth did they think they were doing, eating this stuff and therefore creating this system which does that? So those are two. I mean, I could go on, but so I think those are.
Do you want to add a third? while you've got the magic wand in your hand?
Magic wand. A third, the third for me, which I think is something that partly comes from having grown up in a different place and having seen my parents grow old in a different place, is I think we've got something really wrong about the way we're locking away so many old people. I mean, it looks like many old people are neglected and but also separated from the rest of society.
Put honor in that equation.
Well, I honor thy father and thy mother is the simple thing. Honor thy grandmother and thy grandfather. I think of the difference between the way my mother died in Ghana, which was surrounded by people, young people who came to see her regularly from her church and so on, who took pleasure in being around an older person. She was able to die at home because people looked after her. My sister lived next door and so on. And then the way in which many people grow old on their own in this country. And I think, you know, we... It's a global question because as we go through this vast demographic transition that's going on in the world, there'll be more and more societies where the average age is quite high and there'll be large numbers of people in their 70s and 80s and 90s. And getting it to be right that the people in the last now third of their lives or 20% of their lives lead lives of dignity and engagement with the rest of us, that we don't just... forget about them. That seems to me another one where I think our grandchildren, I hope our grandchildren will care about this, because otherwise, you know, my old age is going to be a depressing one, I suspect. So I think those are three entirely different kinds of things, but they all have this pattern to them that there is a problem. We already know there's a problem. We're, to some extent, trying not to think about it a lot of the time, the strategic ignorance thing, and nevertheless, it's beginning to be recognized. People are beginning to organize around this and say, we just can't go on like this. We have to do something about it.
Kwame Anthony Appiah, The Honor Code, it was for me a hugely stimulating book. It's a privilege to sit at the knee of a cosmopolitan philosopher. Thank you for the conversation. Thank you for your work.
Thank you for your questions. And it's nice to talk to you always.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.